Hello and welcome to the KGNU Morning Magazine for Wednesday, April 28th. I'm Sam Fuqua. Still ahead this half hour, the Boulder City Council wants to hire more police in response to homelessness. We'll have a report. Then an update on hunger in Boulder County. Shannon Young visits a local food bank to find out more about the need and how you can help. We'll also hear our regular Wednesday features, Make Them Hear You, and local herbalist Brigitte Mars with Naturally. A BBC update and commentary from Jim Hightower at the bottom of the hour. At 8:35 this morning, Rosanna Longo talks with Dr. Sabrina Valpone from the Leeds School of Business at CU Boulder. They'll discuss the barriers to overcoming inequality in the workplace for women and how that is particularly an issue for women of color. At 9 o'clock, we hear about an online Persian dance festival with a Colorado connection. Persian dance at 9. And our day of eclectic music begins at 9:30 with the Morning Sound Alternative. Today, Ginger Perry celebrating 30 years of E-Town, the Boulder-based music and environmental program. E-Town founder and host Nick Forrester will join Ginger for some conversation with lots of music by E-Town artists. Also ahead this morning on listener-supported KGNU, after these headlines from Jamie Sudler.
A major rock slide last night has resulted in the closure of Colorado Highway 119 from its base in Boulder to the top of the canyon near Nederland. The slide included five truck-sized boulders and happened during heavy rain and snow in the area, referred to as the Narrows of Boulder Canyon Drive. No one was injured and no vehicles were reportedly damaged. CDOT said in a release that specialized rock teams will be brought in to clear the road, but the closure is expected to last well into today. Colorado health officials are imploring people to get vaccinated as the number of coronavirus cases and hospitalizations continue to rise across the state. At a news conference yesterday, Governor Jared Polis said that thousands of appointments or walk-up slots are available for the next few days across the state, and more vaccination sites are offering walk-up slots. Polis said that a major task now is urging those who didn't get the vaccine to get it.
It's not a resistance to vaccine issue. It is what you might call a hesitancy or laziness issue. It's people who've, and we know this from research, they will get the vaccine, but it's not immediate in their minds. They're thinking, I'll get it in the future, maybe in a month, maybe in 2 months, maybe at some indefinite date. Well, that time is now. Step up and get it.
Coronavirus cases are still increasing across the state, but Dr. Rachel Herlihy said the state epidemiologist, said that the increase is slower than in recent weeks. Cases among 11 to 17-year-olds, middle school and high school students, are now occurring at a higher rate than among people at age 18 and older. The Colorado Sun reports that more than half of Coloradans have received at least one coronavirus vaccine, and about a third of the eligible population is fully vaccinated. But children age 16 and under are not yet eligible for the corona vaccine. Experts hope that that will change before the next school year begins in the fall, as vaccines are approved for younger people. The majority of the 622 people hospitalized for COVID-19 in Colorado as of yesterday are under the age of 60, according to the Department of Public Health and Environment. People between the ages of 40 and 59 make up the largest group, and just over a fifth are between 20 and 39 years old. Governor Polis said also yesterday in a statement that students and parents should expect to see vaccine requirements for the school year starting in the fall. Yesterday at the state capitol, a health care measure advanced in a House committee, but it was substantially changed from what was once known as the public option bill. Now, the proposed bill no longer includes a state-run option, but instead would force insurers to offer a standardized plan developed by the insurance commissioner and to cut insurance costs for consumers using the individual or small group marketplace. The latest version of House Bill 1232 was rewritten following feedback from insurers in the healthcare industry. Now, most of the top healthcare groups and organizations, including the Colorado Hospital Association, will take a neutral stance on the measure rather than opposing it. Under the proposal, the healthcare industry is required to reduce premium costs by 6% a year for 3 years starting in 2023 for a total of 18%. One of the bill's sponsors, Dylan Roberts, a Democrat from Eagle, said the change from the original bill's 20% over 2 years is a major concession. Colorado Politics reports that even with those major concessions, the bill's road to the governor's desk does not look easy. The Boulder City Council heard yesterday that the city is in a better financial position than was expected at this point, but officials said that the coronavirus pandemic's impact won't be going away anytime soon, and the city likely won't be able to restore all of the services this year that have been cut because of the pandemic. Chris Meskuk, interim city manager, said that hard decisions will have to be made about what services or things that were cut back can come back, or which are going to wait a little longer. The Daily Camera reports that Boulder's economic recovery continues to lag, and the city is concerned about some systemic shifts, such as a continued push to work from home, that could affect restaurants, retail stores, and other service-based businesses. We'll have more on the council meeting after headlines. In today's weather, it looks like the rain will continue until about 2 p.m., then gradually become mostly sunny, with a high near 57. Tomorrow, sunny skies with highs in the upper 60s. Right now, it's about 41 along the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
Ten minutes after 8 now at listener-supported KGNU. The majority of Boulder City Council members agreed last night that hiring more police officers is necessary to deal with homelessness in the city. KGNU's Roz Brown has more.
During the study session last night, the majority of Boulder City Council members agreed that increased spending is necessary to remove and discourage homeless encampments. While no official vote was taken, council reviewed a set of staff recommendations to spend $2.7 million over 18 months to address the issue. They also discussed the possibility of supporting sanctioned encampments, recently embraced in Denver and elsewhere, as an alternative to indoor shelters during COVID. But Mayor Sam Weaver led off the opposition to bringing such camping to Boulder.
I guess I'll just start out by saying that I thought this was a good idea once years ago, and I have changed my mind. The reason that I changed my mind is because another council member and I spent a long time trying to find a nonprofit that would work with us to set up one. We couldn't find one. The most important indicator of success of one of these is a strong nonprofit partner. I don't believe we've ever identified one. There have been people who claim to be willing to do it, but I haven't seen any kind of history or background that they were capable or ready. So we're missing that key element that we've tried to find. And without that, I just don't think there's any legs to this. The city isn't built to do such a campground on its own. So I'll just say that I think one reason I'm not going to support anything like this is because we don't have a partner who's willing to step up and run it.
Councilmember Bob Yates was even more opposed to sanctioned encampments.
I'm opposed to sanctioned campground for five reasons. Number one, we have more than an adequate number of shelter beds available. We have dozens of beds unused on any given night. I really struggle with why we would have a sanctioned campground and ask people to sleep outside under canvas tents, and we have perfectly good bricks and mortars that we have spent millions of dollars on and beds that are available and unused every night. Number two, I do understand that there are some people who won't go to the shelter. Some reasons I think are a little specious. Other reasons are probably quite legitimate. And the one that I hear most often that's legitimate is PTSD. But let's take care of that issue head on. Rather than creating a sanctioned campground to address people with PTSD who may not even avail themselves of the campground, let's address those people's unique problems with unique solutions.
But Councilmember Aaron Brockett pushed back on Yates' opposition.
I am in favor of exploring this. I mean, I think, Bob, I think we don't know that it wouldn't work. There are successful examples, with the most recent and most nearby one being Denver, where their Safe Outdoor Spaces program in the last 9 months has been quite successful, both in providing places, people with an alternative place to sleep, and for transitioning people, some number of people in permanent housing. We've been talking tonight about various ways of stepped up enforcement of the camping ban, of saying to people, well, you can't sleep here. It's not legal to sleep here. But I think we need to also have answers for where can you go? And the shelter, obviously, is a really good one, and it's a good facility, and it works for a lot of people, but it does not work for everyone. We do have people that fall through the cracks and don't have options available to them. So while we're stepping up enforcement, I think we should also be looking at providing some alternatives, alternative services that can they can work for people for whom existing services don't.
Councilmember Mary Young said she would support an alternative.
I won't be supporting this, but I do support the housing for people that are addicted to meth, which has been one of the focuses and one of the things that has been determined by staff based on the data that they see out in the field, that people with meth addiction need places to be able to kick the addiction.
Finally, Councilmember Junie Joseph explained why she had changed her mind on supporting sanctioned encampments.
You know, coming into council, I was a proponent, and this idea of a pilot sounded good to me, but I had a conversation with a community member, and she asked me, where would that sanctioned camp be located? Surely it's probably not going to be in some of the rich areas where there are a couple of million-dollar homes. It's probably going to be in the areas where there are a lot of minorities or people who are not making a lot of money, working class people in those blighted areas of Boulder, where, you know, it's going to even lower the area even more. So I thought to myself, wow, that's interesting that you brought that point forward, because again, as community leaders, it's great to bring ideas forward, but at the same time, we still have to think about the impact of our ideas or policies on other people in the community. So I think that equity piece is very important.
Boulder City Council is expected to take an official vote on the homelessness policies next month. For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
8:16 now at KGNU. A tanker truck carrying 8,000 gallons of gasoline capsized on Highway 36 near Apple Valley Road in Lyons yesterday, spilling an unknown quantity of gas into the North St. Vrain Creek. The Boulder County Sheriff's Office, the Colorado State Patrol, and the Environmental Protection Agency all responded to the spill. Listener Andres Better, who is also the son of KGNU reporter Rosanna Longo, happened upon the scene and spoke with a utility services company worker who was in the area when the accident happened.
So what happened is that we got a tanker that has spilled a significant amount of fuel that has gone into the flow and drainage and into the river. So it's an EPA issue. Right now, my company's doing locates for gas because they're going to be excavating. That's essentially what's going on. I'm not sure if the driver is okay, but that's the situation. It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate for the St. Vrain, and I'm sure they've responded rather quickly, so we're sure that EPA is going to do everything that they can.
Photos from the scene show an oily sheen in the water and multiple dead fish. Region 8 of the EPA says they are hoping to complete response work in the next 2 or 3 days. Victoria Simonson, town administrator for Lyons, told the Daily Camera that fish were dying off fast and the trout industry had just picked up from the flood of 2013. She also said she informed the city of Longmont about the spill because Lyons gets its water from Longmont. However, Longmont released a statement saying its water was not affected by the spill because it diverted the river above where the spill occurred. 18 minutes after 8 now, the pandemic has taken a heavy economic toll on many households, and when the rent and bills are due, sometimes spending on food suffers. Newly compiled data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture shows that spending on food assistance programs jumped 30% last fiscal year to a record-breaking $122 billion. Anecdotal evidence from food banks indicates a similar trend for 2021. The increased demand puts pressure on social safety nets, and organizations that provide assistance are balancing the health of their staff with the needs of those seeking help. For nearly 3 decades, the National Association of Letter Carriers has carried out a food drive to collect non-perishable food items on doorsteps across the country. The drive usually happens the second Saturday in May, and KGNU has long been a partner in these efforts locally. This year, the letter carriers have moved their efforts online to a donor drive. Funds collected in Boulder County will go to the food banks of Sister Carmen Community Center and Emergency Family Assistance Association, or EFA, as it's known for short. KGNU's Shannon Young stopped by EFA to see how the food pantry works and spoke with a letter carrier about the food drive.
Every corner of the Emergency Family Assistance Association is bustling, even before its food pantry opens to the public. A truck filled with donated food backs up to a loading dock, while volunteers stock shelves ahead of the afternoon rush.
We're open Monday through Friday, and we see about 40 or 50 people a day.
Walter O'Toole is the food bank manager at EFA. He says since the start of the pandemic, a broader range of individuals are now seeking out food assistance.
I do know we recently completed a food bank survey, and about 25% of the people who are coming in now, their first visit to the food bank has been in 6 months or less. At least that's what they told us. So, we're seeing a lot of new people whose, you know, needs have increased due to the pandemic.
O'Toole says that stigma can often be an issue when people come to a food bank for the first time, and EFA has implemented a couple of measures to make the ask easier for those in need. For starters, there's now less paperwork involved, as food bank assistant Sherry McCundin explains.
Currently, we're not asking for any documentation during this time. That might change. In the past, we've asked for an interview with the case manager, who then asks them about all their backgrounds and is able to offer them other services in the area, like that we might not provide. Oh, but you need this. Yeah. So, but right now, anybody who needs food can come.
And one of the other things that we have recently implemented in the last couple of years is a participant volunteer policy.
That's EFA's communications director, Ashley Rumble.
So a lot of the folks who come in for food are now able to volunteer with us and do volunteer with us. So it really becomes less of this handout and more of this community model of getting food to people who need it.
The inside of the food pantry resembles a small grocery store. Before the pandemic, clients were able to grab a shopping cart and pick out what they wanted. But as a precautionary measure due to the enclosed space, volunteers now fill orders based on selections clients make on a menu of what's available. Food bank manager Walter O'Toole says the food comes from various sources. The U.S. Department of Agriculture provides around 10% of the inventory, but most of it comes from donations.
83% of the food we get is donated, and we work with partners like Community Food Share, a large regional food bank, to get that. We also partner with local grocery stores and pick up donations from them. And we work with different community organizations, schools, faith groups, the Postal Service, and to host food drives in the community to get the things that we need.
One of those food drives is underway now, organized by the National Association of Letter Carriers. Diane Santoyo is a letter carrier in Boulder and the NALC's local food drive coordinator. For 27 years, the letter carriers would collect bags of non-perishable food items from doorsteps on their mail routes. But the pandemic forced the drive into an online space this year and the last.
In its place, we've put together a donor drive, which is online that people across America have access to and can make a monetary donation. All they need to do is go to nalc.org/food, choose their state, and a list of food pantries will come up nearest to them. And that will direct them to the website of their food pantry, and then they will be able to make their donation in cash.
The letter carriers time their drives for the spring because that's when a lull tends to occur and stocks of non-perishable items dwindle after the holiday high season donations. Santoyo says letter carriers are uniquely positioned not only for donation pickup during normal years, but also for outreach efforts in times of need.
The reason why this whole food drive has happened by the letter carriers is that we do go into our communities 6 days a week. there's thousands of us who come face to face with the faces of our community.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture found that spending on food assistance programs jumped 30% last fiscal year, showing an increased need nationwide. EFA's food bank manager, Walter O'Toole, had the following advice. If you need food assistance, don't wait until your situation is dire. For KGNU, I'm Shannon Young in Boulder.
8:24 now at KGNU. Time for our regular Wednesday morning feature, Make Them Hear You.
Make them hear you. Make them hear you.
This is Make Them Hear You with ideas how you can have your voice heard before Congress. Marijuana dispensaries have to deal in cash-only transactions because the drug is illegal under federal law, and no bank can accept money from illegal activities. So there's no easy, secure way for cannabis sellers to legally put their money in a U.S. bank. The amount of cash these businesses carry makes them a target. The Safe Banking Act of 2021, or Secure and Fair Enforcement Banking Act of 2021, was reintroduced recently and sponsored again in the U.S. House of Representatives by our own Colorado Congressman Ed Perlmutter, where it recently passed. It now awaits passage in the U.S. Senate, where it was sponsored by Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon. At a time, too, when Washington, D.C. is particularly partisan, cannabis banking reform seems to be one area both parties can agree on. Safe banking out of the gate has overwhelming support on both sides of the political aisle. The bill passed the U.S. House on April 19th by a vote of 321 to 101, and in the U.S. Senate, more than 30 bipartisan sponsors have signed on to the bill. Currently, 36 states, 4 U.S. territories, and the District of Columbia have legalized the medical use of cannabis, and 18 states, 2 territories, and the District of Columbia have also legalized recreational use by adults over 21. Without federally approved banking services, state-licensed cannabis businesses cannot write checks, make or receive electronic payments, utilize a payroll provider, or accept credit and debit cards. 321,000 cannabis employees work in the industry, and they are prime targets for violent theft and fraud. The safe banking legislation would remove barriers for state and financial institutions to work with the state's legal cannabis companies. It would allow more traditional lending accessibility for the industry and alleviate a lack of access to capital, which has been particularly tough on smaller businesses. Separately, a new addition to the 2021 legislation from the 2019 version is the clarity it gives on the protections to financial service providers who work within the hemp industry. The industry as it stands is stuck and cannot continue to grow and expand as it is in a cash-only environment. Every day it stays in its current state is another day our public safety remains at risk. The SAFE Act enjoys bipartisan support, as I've mentioned, and if you'd like to see it pass in the Senate, you can contact your senators. This is Chris Moore with Make Them Hear You.
Make them hear you. Make them hear you. And tell them in our struggle we would not be only ones made.
Greetings, welcome to Naturally. This is Brigitte Mars. One of the first spring flowers is violet. You've probably seen it. Maybe you've even caught a whiff on the air of this awesome scent. Just for a moment, a sure sign of spring. So violet has heart-shaped leaves and small purple flowers, although there can also be white flowers, sometimes yellow. But what we most commonly have here in Colorado is Viola odorata, with a beautiful aroma. The genus name Viola comes from the Ione word in Greek mythology, a woman that was Zeus's lover, and Zeus's wife Hera did not really like this very much, so she turned Ione into a heifer. That sounds dreadful. And Ione wept, and Zeus turned her tears into violets to give her something wonderful to gaze upon. There's a lot of weird mythologies like that. What can I say? Well, the good news is that violet is a very early spring flower, and you can eat the leaves. They are a traditional remedy that has long been used to clear heat, reduce inflammation, deter infection, and have even been used as an anti-cancer remedy throughout history. So violet leaves can be made into a salad. They can also be made into a tea. Violets are considered a symbol of innocence and modesty, and ancient Romans placed violet flowers upon the graves of children. But do you know that you can also eat the violet flowers? Now, don't think that all purple flowers are edible, because there's other things blooming and they are not. But violet flowers are amazing. If you put them in white vinegar, it turns the vinegar a beautiful purple color. And violet flowers can be used to make candied violets, or I love to use them to decorate a salad or a cake. So you've got edible flowers, edible leaves. You can make a tea out of the leaves. You can just simply put the flowers in cold water and make a cold water infusion. One of the folk names for violet is heart's ease. It's said to be good for a broken heart, a sad heart. Violet leaves can also be used topically to treat infection, boils, compress for cysts. So this is truly an amazing herb, and it makes a great ground cover. It doesn't grow very tall. You can eat the leaves and the flowers any time of the year, and it smells great. Why grow grass when you can have violets? Thanks for joining me, Brigitte Mars, on Naturally.